we're going to be talking with an attorney. And I know some of you are saying, I don't know if I want to listen to an attorney on the radio. The world has too many attorneys anyway. You might even live in Montpelier, which is allegedly the attorney capital of the U.S. I've heard it has the highest number of attorneys of any state in per capita of any state in the any city in the country. But this is a different sort of attorney. Janelle Orsi is an attorney who wants to make the world safe for people who aren't attorneys. She has published, along with her co-author, Emily Doskow, a book called The Sharing Solution: How to Save Money, Simplify Your Life, and Build Community. And it got my attention, not only from that great title, but also because it's a publisher. The publisher is Nolo Press. And as their text says, they're the leading publisher of plain English legal and business tools. It's a whole press devoted to making it easier for you to live your life in a very law-driven, litigious society without hiring a lawyer. And so it was with great interest that I picked up The Sharing Solution: How to Save Money, Simplify Your Life, and Build Community. And read it and talked to her co-author, Emily Doskow, on my other radio show about a month ago, and had such a great time talking to her that invited Janelle Orsi to be on the show with us today. So we're going to talk with her. I'd also like to hear your accounts of sharing. What do you share? How does it work for you? We'll take calls starting in about 10 minutes or so after we have a talk about the basic structure of the book. And the local number here is 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Janelle Orsi, all the way from the Bay Area in California, welcome to Equal Time.
Well, thank you so much, Carl. Thanks for the introduction.
So tell me, how did you come to write a book about sharing and all the various different ways that people can and do share things with each other?
Well, I guess the longer story, since you mentioned that I'm a lawyer but not a scary one, is that I did go to law school because I wanted to make the world a better place, and a lot of what I was planning to do was things like juvenile defense, maybe trying to improve the education system, defend youth who are in trouble and so on. But after a while, I realized that I'm just fighting a system that's not really changing. And then I started to think about ways to improve the community where youth are growing up, or just the community that we're living in general. And in Berkeley, where I live, I started to see a lot of interesting things like community gardens. I saw people sharing cars and car sharing programs. I saw co-housing communities. And I thought, wow, this is the change I want to see in the world. This is making our communities more supportive places, making them safer places. It's giving people opportunities, and it's also meeting people's material needs. And what I saw tying all these things together is that people are sharing resources. And so I formed a law practice that would be focused on helping people share resources, figuring out the logistics and the administrative side of how to share a car with your neighbor or how to buy a house with a friend and so on. And then I met an attorney from Nolo and ended up writing a book about it.
And so that's really important to emphasize, that this book grows out of your practical experiences, that for every chapter, even every sub-chapter here, it seems, you have stories of people who are actually sharing things in the way that you describe. It's not just a theoretical realm.
Right. And I definitely realized when I started to see people around me sharing, I realized that there are definitely barriers, and those barriers are usually just people's fears about what happens if there's a liability issue, what happens if there's some sort of loss or damage, or what happens if there's an argument between the people who are sharing. And so I just wanted to help people overcome these barriers, and we created this book as basically a toolkit, so that if someone thinks, I would like to share a car with my neighbor, they could pick up this book, pull out the sample agreement, and get going with it.
So the way that you and your co-author, Emily Doskow, teamed up to write The Sharing Solution is that you came in with the experience in sharing law, and Emily Doskow is also an attorney, and she'd previously worked with Nolo Press in book writing. Is that it?
Exactly. And she's a family law specialist, but she brings with her many years of experience practicing law in general. So we were able to team up and put together this toolkit.
Well, I guess it's fitting that a book on sharing would be shared between two authors.
Right, yeah. It worked well that way.
So there are a number of of reasons for sharing that you've already gone through here, and you go through in more detail in your book. Why don't you share with us? You play a game of 20 questions, or at least you list 20 questions to ask when you share. Why don't you go through some of the more important ones that you think people ought to be thinking about?
Okay. Well, in the book, we did create a list of 20 questions because when people come together to share something, let's say they're going to form a tool lending library in their neighborhood. So they need to sit down and have everybody ask questions like, what happens if some of the tools break? How are we going to bring in new members of the group? What if members of the group want to leave? How are we going to divide expenses? How are we going to deal with liability if that comes up? So there's this whole list of 20 questions that people can talk through and then put into writing. So we've given people guidelines if they want to create a written agreement. Then they can do that.
Yeah, my life as a consultant, I worked one time with an attorney to set up a special sort of pioneering water and wastewater ordinance for a small town in Missouri, and she kept throwing these worst case scenarios at us and saying, "That's my job. I'm an attorney." So I think about that when I hear your questions about what to do when tools break and so on.
Right. Well, on the other hand, my co-author and I are both mediators, so we're both thinking about worst-case scenarios, but we're really thinking that, more importantly, is how do you get people to trust each other and build strong communication relationships? So we spend a good part of the book giving tips on how to communicate with people without making issues personal, without seeming distrustful, and so it's kind of a balance. It's a balance between setting good boundaries but also opening yourself up to new things.
Right. Well, one of the boundaries that I've seen some people set is that they're okay with informal neighborly cooperation, sharing, trading favors, things like that. Mm-hmm. But as soon as it comes to putting something in writing, even if there's no lawyer involved, just putting something in writing, then they kind of back off and shy off and say, "Boy, that's not the sort of relationship I thought this was, or that's just not the sort of thing I do." What are your comments about that?
Well, we recommend that people put things in writing in a lot of different situations. And in many circumstances, it's not necessary, but it can be helpful. So if you're doing something as simple as creating a tool lending library with neighbors, putting it in writing may not be necessary, but it will help you all get on the same page with your expectations. It'll make sure that everyone understands how the process works. It'll make sure everyone understands who owns what. And because it can be hard, many years into an arrangement like this, to remember some of the things that you agreed on at the outset. And also it could be a handy reference for people. So if another neighbor moves on into the neighborhood and wants to join, they could look at that piece of writing and understand how the whole process works. So there's a lot of good reasons to put things in writing, even if you're not needing it to be a legal agreement. And then when it comes to things like sharing a car or sharing a home, something of a lot of value, we say definitely put it into writing because even if you're going to get along fine, if something really bad happens, like liability or somebody dies or somebody has to sell part of the car, like you really need to know how you're going to deal with that. And putting it in writing can help ease everyone's worries.
And I like your suggestion that when you put it in writing, you not only detail what is to be shared and how it's to be shared, but the goals for the sharing. And tell us the example that you use in the book about taking down the fence and writing down goals about kids using the yard.
Oh, okay. If I remember this example correctly, I mean, if two neighbors want to take down a fence between their yards, they may or may not be on the same page in terms of their expectations. So sometimes it's a good idea to just jot down why you're taking down the fence. Are you doing it so that just to give the kids more space to run around, or are you doing it so that you can garden in each other's yards? Or I think the example we gave is that if one neighbor gets goats and starts grazing them in the other neighbor's yards, that might be beyond the expectations. And so one thing is to just to let everybody know why you're doing it and what's the scope of why you're doing it.
Right. With goats, it can be a little ambiguous because goats have kids too, of course.
That's right. Yeah, good point.
Okay, and there's just a range of things that you talk about sharing here that probably a lot of people wouldn't have thought about. What's one of the more unusual things that you found people sharing?
More unusual things. Well, you know, something that I've been hearing about constantly lately, and I don't know if it's part of the whole go local, eat sustainable, organic food movement, but people are sharing chickens so often these days, and I hear about neighbors who are getting together and building a chicken coop and buying a bunch of chickens and then taking turns caring for the chickens and feeding them and then sharing the eggs. And it's really, if you think about it, it's a great idea because one person can really only do so much with chickens. I mean, you can maybe have one or two chickens and they'll give you, oh, who knows, half a dozen eggs per week or more. But it's a lot of trouble to go and build a coop and to be there every day to take care of them. But if a group of people can take care of chickens, they could, you know, get 14 chickens and get about 7 dozen eggs a week. And you can do a whole lot more in a group when you're sharing chickens. So I guess that's one of the more interesting things I've heard about.
Well, I'll second the trouble of building a coop. I'm in the process of building a chicken tractor for my chickens right now. It's a fairly simple structure, but it just takes time and hours out there ripping lumber and screwing the pieces together and doing a little design on the fly, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So there's so much that we can do cooperating that we probably wouldn't do as individuals all alone, and I guess that's one of them.
I'm going to use a capitalist model with this. I'm going to sell the eggs from the dozen or so layers that I have. But sharing's another possible solution. And I know that people in our neighborhood have shared chickens. The story about sharing chickens that you tell and how frequently it comes up, that's something that you've written recently on your blog. So it's why don't you talk about your blog and let people know what the website is for that.
Okay, well, thanks for noticing my blog, first of all. It's www.sharingsolution.com. And we're using the blog just as an opportunity to stay up to date on new sharing developments that we hear about. And so things like chicken sharing and interesting websites that come up, we're just trying to keep it updated. But it's interesting how, after we publish the book, how quickly it becomes outdated because the developments in sharing are occurring so fast. Like every day we hear about an interesting new website or a group of people doing something that we'd never heard about before. And so it's really starting to feel like a movement.
Well, if you want to give us a call and tell us about some of the sharing that you're doing, give us a call at the local number 244-1777 or toll free 877-291-8255. Maybe we can get some new sharing examples for you, Janelle Orsi, to put on your blog. We're talking with Janelle Orsi. She's the author of The Sharing Solution, How to Save Money, Simplify Your Life, and Build Community. New book just out in May. I'm Carl Ettenauer. You're listening to Equal Time Radio on WDEV. And we have Nancy Rice calling in from Montpelier. Hello, Nancy.
Yes, good morning. Well, I guess it's afternoon. Sorry, I was in traffic for so long, Carl. Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
This is Nancy Rice. I'm with the Go Vermont Carpool and Vanpool Program with the Agency of Transportation in Montpelier.
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yeah, hi, Janelle.
Hello.
I'm looking forward to getting a copy of your book and reading it.
Well, thank you. So you manage a vanpool or a carpool program, is that what you said?
Yes, it's called Go Vermont, and it is the former Vermont Rideshare. It's the carpool and vanpool program, and it's operated under the umbrella of the Agency of Transportation through our public transit section. And it's a carpool matching service, as well as a vanpool program, which we have contracted with a vanpool company to offer the vanpool service to the Vermonters, just the state of Vermont, Vermonters, employees and employers alike.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so it is. It's very exciting.
So this is a case where the government has stepped in and facilitated sharing amongst individuals.
That's correct. And we currently have a database with everybody registered who used to be through the public transit providers under Vermont Rideshare, and now they're all under one database. And it's a manually matching program to begin with. People do go online, they register what their needs are, and we coordinate matches for them. And they're encouraged to also go online to some carpool ads that we post and continue to update with the more registrations that we receive. We are moving to an automated matching system that will be coming live this fall, and this will be enable people to go on, establish their own account, and do their own matching. It'll be much faster and more efficient.
Oh, that's great. Do you help people share their expenses too? So if someone rides with someone else, do they deposit mileage costs?
We completely leave that up to the individuals. Mm-hmm. We have various hints and tips on carpooling and vanpooling and getting to know people on our website. There's a common sense factor, but some people prefer to use one car one week, another car another week. That works out. Some people like to just ride and not drive at all, in which case they can work out whatever works for them, sharing the gas cost, that type of thing.
Oh, that's great.
But it's very individual.
Why don't you give us that website, Nancy?
Yes, it's www.
Yep.
ConnectingCommuters, all one word, .org.
ConnectingCommuters.org.
.org.
And that doesn't have Vermont anywhere in the URL, but it is a Vermont-specific website or not?
That's correct. It is Vermont-specific.
And
The only thing with GoVermont is when you try, sometimes when you plug it in, you get government. But you can also plug in Go Vermont. I think you will get Rideshare Vermont. It will go to Connecting Commuters or Go Vermont.
GoVermont.org is an alternative, but ConnectingCommuters.org is the...
That is the key website.
The key website.
Yeah, that should take you directly there.
And last time I checked in with your office, Nancy, you did something very helpful to people who were afraid that, okay, if I'm in a carpool and I don't have my own car at work and I hear that my kid has an emergency at school or somehow I need to get home, you did something to allay the fears that they'd be stuck at work.
Exactly. You're absolutely right, Carl. And this is one of the things that we love to talk about as well. It's a benefit. It's one of two that we have, but it's a key benefit. It's called the Guaranteed Ride Home Card. And through our program, through the Go Vermont program, member carpools and vanpools, each member of that carpool receives a guaranteed ride home card generic to that carpool or vanpool number. This enables them up to six times a year to receive a reimbursement of $70 maximum. If they're at work, their child is sick, they are sick, they have to get home, they have to leave, and they have no other way to get there because they're in a carpool.
So you can get a taxi and
get a taxi, get a bus, whatever is going to work. But and you can use it six times a year, no more than twice in 1 month.
Mm.
And it's up to $70 reimbursed. We have a form on the website and guidelines on how to use it as well.
What I found is
I
like your flexibility in saying what it can be reimbursed for, because what I found is someone who's lived a fair amount of my adult life without owning a car is that people can be quite willing to rent me their car on a per mile basis if I pay the federal rate, which is currently around 50 cents a mile. So you can go a ways on $70.
Yes, for an emergency situation. And like I said, there are the guidelines and also the reimbursement form that is available on the website. And when we receive new carpools, I send all the members their carpool, their registration card for guaranteed ride home, as well as the information. We also provide a parking pass for that vanpool or carpool, which enables them, when they display it, to take advantage of reserved carpool or vanpool parking spots. So obviously it's on a first-come, first-served basis. But
Janelle Orsi, author of The Sharing Solution, your comments on this Connecting Commuters program.
Well, that just sounds great, especially because the caller just talked about being stuck in traffic. It sounds like probably needed there, something that's going to take this whole sea of cars with just one driver in them.
Well, this is construction-oriented. I'm sorry, Janelle, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, it's construction traffic.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
That's a whole different category.
How does this...
Maybe it's not the kind of traffic I see here in the Bay Area, but anytime
no.
You see a freeway full of cars that just have one person in each car, it's such a terrible use of our resources.
Well, this is one of the things we encourage people is, how many times are you leaving your region, your city, your town, and we're a rural state, and you see X number of cars every day driving in front of you or behind you in the same direction at the same time. And this is where we're working and building the website more and more so people can, to enable people to identify that. And we're working with some companies also on their employee database to help them target different zones so that they can see how many employees do we have coming in from this region every day. For example, and it's a work in progress, but there are companies who are doing it. National Life has done a great job with working on that. And the Vanpool program, if I could speak real briefly about that, would that be okay?
Sure.
It's a huge, we have currently several Vanpools that have started in the state since last October under the Go Vermont program. Two of these are employee-driven, and three of them are employer-driven. What I mean by that is we have two of the Vanpools, and we work with VPSI out of Massachusetts, and the state of Vermont, the Go Vermont program, subsidizes each of our Vanpools under this program a certain amount per month, $500 actually. And this is to encourage people so that they don't have to worry as much about the per seat costs, but you need to start with a minimum of 7 to 8 people who are going in not necessarily the same office or the same employer, but in the same municipality within reason at the same schedule every day. So we have several that are employee driven. Most of them are going to the Waterbury State Office Complex, but they're coming from the south, so they meet at the Randolph Park and Ride. And they travel to the Waterbury State Office Complex. And they're always looking for additional riders as well because not everybody works 5 days a week or on the same schedule. We all have very busy schedules, so it's very flexible. And the arrangement is made completely with the company, and the biggest thing that we do is that we connect them with the company. The company owns the top-of-the-line Ford or Dodge vans, and they're very flexible. They're a wonderful company. And we have one company in Vermont that relocated their business. And to retain their employees who are well-trained and excellent employees, they have brought three Vanpools into the program, into their employee base.
They relocated their business within Vermont?
From Bristol to Essex Junction.
Okay.
And this is Autumn Harp. Mm-hmm. And in order to keep their employees and also make it life much easier without adding a lot of expense to their employees who are well-trained and created their wonderful business that they have three Vanpools now that they operate with their shift employees that take them to Essex Junction.
Hmm.
And, yes.
And can you find out more about the Vanpools at connectingcommuters.org
as well? Yes, you can, and by contacting me, which is that information is also on the website.
Well, Nancy Rice from the Go Vermont programs, thanks so much for calling in.
Well, thank you very much for having me call in. And Janelle, I will be looking forward to reading your book.
Oh, thank you so much, Nancy.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Janelle, I'm going to ask you in a minute to give your reflections on this system and tell us how it compares to other carpool and vanpool systems that you're familiar with. And we'll hear more of your phone calls if you want to call in and tell us about sharing that you're involved with. Either maybe you're in charge of a sharing program, as Nancy Rice is, or you're doing some sharing you'd like to share with us. 244-1777 is a local phone number. 877-291-8255 is the toll-free number. And we'll be back with more sharing right after this.
Hey, neighbor.
Hi, Cheryl. You need another cup of sugar?
I was wondering if I could borrow some internet.
Borrow some internet?
Bandwidth, actually. Since we both have cable internet, it's shared and can really slow down during peak hours.
I've noticed.
So if you log off, I might get more internet speed.
Stop sharing. Get Fairpoint high-speed internet for only $9.99 a month.
Welcome back to Equal Time here on WDEV. I'm Carl Ettenayer. We're talking with Janelle Orsi all the way from the Bay Area in California. She's an attorney and the author of The Sharing Solution, How to Save Money, Simplify Your Life, and Build Community. And boy, I've talked back to some sponsor spots before. I've never had a sponsor spot talk back to me before. But stop sharing, says Fairpoint.
That's very explicit.
Yes. Janelle Orsi talking about sharing. What are your thoughts on the vanpool and carpool solutions that Nancy Rice was talking about?
I think it sounds wonderful. It really sounds like Vermont has got a great program going. I think other parts of the country have yet to catch up in that department, but many of them are moving forward.
But there's also different models that I've heard about that are developing here in the Bay Area, and then in a few other states, there's a lot of casual ride sharing that happens where people gather on a certain street corner or a certain parking lot every day and basically pick up rides with strangers on the spur of the moment. So here we have carpool lanes, which allow you to get by a lot faster, get by the traffic, and also avoid any road tolls. So there's a real incentive for people driving their cars to pick people up and have passengers. And so they just pick up strangers on the side of the road, and there's sort of this this generally known, all these spots that people know to congregate at in the mornings during commute time. So
yeah, I've heard about that here on the East Coast in more crowded places where there are also high occupancy vehicle lanes or tolls or high parking once you get to the city. They call it slugging in the D.C. Baltimore area.
Right.
I'm not sure where that word comes from. And what I've wondered is how do you get here from here? How do you get there? How do you start up the first informal or casual ride sharing?
Well, one way to do it is if there's a central place where a lot of commuters are going, also a place where a lot of them tend to live, you can choose a parking lot. Let's say you can get maybe a church or a school to lend you their parking lot during the day. Then commuters can all go congregate in that lot, and then people can start, when they arrive, getting into each other's cars or consolidating into just a few cars and then driving to where they want to go. So what you can do is start advertising around the neighborhood where the parking lot is, and also put the word out in the central area where people are going to work. And so that's how I've heard about people doing it. They get it going kind of informally like that, and then it just sort of grows.
How would you, I'm thinking of Richmond, for example, which has a park and ride near here that a lot of people use, and it keeps expanding because there are so many cars there. And there are people coming from quite a wide geographical area, is the impression that I get leaving their cars there. Actually, Waterbury has a park and ride, too. We're a pretty rural area. It's more than just putting up notices in the neighborhood. What would you suggest for people where there already is this central place that's being well used to add to the formal carpools and the catching the bus business, this informal or casual ride sharing?
In terms of getting the word out even
further? Yeah.
I guess it depends on how people in a given area communicate. If people are on the internet a lot, if there are listservs in the area that are highly used, I would say that would be a great place to start. Maybe also get a TV spot or, a public service announcement letting people know that this is going on. And one group that I know of, they created this really creative token system where someone got washers from the hardware store and then stamped them with metal. And then everybody who started taking place in the ride sharing, he'd give them like 10 or so washers. And so every time you get into a car with somebody, you give the driver one of the washers. But then every time you drive somebody else, they'll give you the coins. So so it's a way that all the costs even out for everybody who takes part in these. Of course, it assumes that everybody has a car, that they would go to a certain spot, park it, and then consolidate into other people's cars.
Some people might want to bike to the parking lot and carpool from there.
Right, yeah.
In which case, they could go buy washers at the hardware store and tap them themselves. Counterfeit some money.
Perhaps.
Washers are cheap.
Yeah.
Well, in your book, The Sharing Solution, Janelle Orsi, you write about a whole bunch of different ways to share transportation. For example, you talk about car share clubs. Tell us about those.
Well, car sharing really makes a lot of sense. I've recently learned that the average household in the U.S. has about 2.28 cars. And especially in households where there's two adults and two or three cars, you could actually, if you're sharing cars with your neighbors, you could probably get each household down to one or one and a half cars, because neighbors who live close to each other are really in a good position to share a car with each other, especially if some neighbors work at home during the day and use the car during the day, while other neighbors commute to work by bus or something and only use the car in the evening. So there's a lot of different ways you can arrange it, and so we've given a lot of different examples. The most simple is just sharing a car with your neighbor, just taking one car and sharing ownership of it. But another thing that neighborhoods can do if they're organized about it is you could have 10 neighbors sharing three cars. And when you have 10 neighbors sharing three cars, there's a greater likelihood that a car is going to be available when you need it. And it could also give people the opportunity to afford things like hybrids or electric vehicles because people will be pooling their resources.
Mm. I like the idea of boosting the number of people involved because of the law of large numbers does mean that it's more likely there's going to be something available for you.
Right.
I was talking to someone once who told me about living in college with, I think, two other people in the house once and one bathroom, and that was a problem all semester. And then she moved into a house with 14 people and two bathrooms, and there was never any waiting time.
That's funny. Yeah, it somehow works out that way. So it takes a lot more administration and planning when you have that many people sharing three cars, but it could be worth it. It could also save people a lot of money.
Right, and you give some details in the book on how to do the planning and administration.
Exactly.
And, of course, we do have car share program companies already started in Vermont that do that. There's one called Car Share Vermont that started up in Burlington last year, if I remember correctly. And this national company, which I think got started where you are in California, called Zipcar, has an office in Middlebury.
That's right. That's great. Yeah, and those companies, they'll place the cars all around the town so that people who are members of their program can go to the car and either swipe a card or enter a code, get access to the car, use it for around town trips, and then return it and have the mileage charged to their account.
Mm. Now you talk about a famous car sharer in the book, a baseball player.
Right, I believe that's Willie Mays. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So I put that in there. My co-author is a big baseball fan, big Giants fan. So I thought that would be a fun thing to put in there, but I didn't actually remember which baseball player it was. But he, I guess it was in the 50s. I really don't know baseball. I wish I knew the date, but he got a huge check when he signed on with the Giants for about $50,000, and he bought a nice car with it. But at the time, he didn't know how to drive, so he would park the car at the stadium, and he'd just let anybody drive it, you know, any of his friends or other players. And so it was kind of a community thing that he did.
Hmm. And another famous carpooler is Dagwood Bumstead of Blondie cartoon fame. And, of course, he's perennially sleeping through his alarm clock, rushing out the door and smashing into the mailman as he delivers the mail, and making the rest of the people in his carpool late, which doesn't really give good advertising for carpoolers. what are your suggestions as someone looking at worst cases and things like this for handling someone who in your carpool who's chronically late?
Yeah, well, it's a good idea to come up with a plan of exactly how long you're going to wait for somebody who's late and how you're going to get a hold of them if they're not coming out of their houses or whatever. And so, yeah, it's definitely good to talk through these things and to know who's prone to oversleeping and know who can be there as a backup if that person doesn't get a ride and that kind of thing. But when you're sharing, it's really important to be on top of these kinds of things. And I for one, would probably be more likely to get out the door on time if there's a carpool waiting for me. So. So, yeah, it's just about being accountable to others.
I like the story you tell in the book about the casual carpool that started out with the person with the clipboard and the cell phone standing there, making sure everybody was coming, going, and everybody got their ride. And then it evolved into something self-organizing where everybody knew, show up at 7:15 in the morning at the parking lot and or just before that, and the rides leave at 7:15. If you're not there at 7:15, we assume you're driving alone or not going in today.
Right. It worked really well. And that's the system I was mentioning that used the tokens, washers that they stamped.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was a very self-organizing system.
Mm.
Didn't take much administration at all.
And then you give a little tantalizing hint about systems from over in Europe that might come to this country that would magically during the day convert your car into your privately owned car into a car share car.
Right. This would be wonderful because a lot of people do leave the house in the morning and their car is just sitting there during the day being idle. And so what this company does is it takes over the use of your car during the day. It insures it for those hours and it installs a numerical code on the door so you can get in. And then people who are members of the program can use your car during the day by entering the code and driving it around and then returning it to your driveway when they're when they're done. So it's a great way to make use of these otherwise bored cars.
Bored cars?
Yeah.
So
it's a boring life for a car.
Right. Poor things. So instead of you paying for parking all day long, you get paid for having your car drive around, serving other people.
Yeah, it seems like a great way to use resources. Also reduce the number of cars just sitting around and the amount of real estate we devote to parking spots and,
and you,
so on.
You wrote that people might even be able to pay for the cost of their cars this way.
Yeah, I suppose that after a while the returns will add up and make it really cheap to own your car.
And Go Geronimo. What's Go Geronimo?
It actually doesn't exist anymore. I believe it was replaced by a public transportation system. But what it was is there's a town of Geronimo near where I live in Northern California where there's one main highway that goes through the town and connects it to the rest of the Bay Area. And so they created what they called the Safe Hitchhiking Program where people in the town, I think they had about 400 people registered, would do a background check, and then get a special ID card so that they could stand out, hold up a sign by the side of the highway, and get picked up by registered drivers. And so this turned out to be a great way, especially for kids. It was mainly kids taking part in this program to get to school and whatnot, would stand out by the side of the highway, hold up their sign, and then when one of the registered drivers came by, they'd check each other's ID to make sure that they're registered and hop in and get a free ride. And so it was a good way to get kids to where they needed to go.
A lot of people that I've been talking about with in the last couple of years and trying to think through transportation solutions for Vermont, a very rural state where people drive more on average than in other states, have brought up something like this. I've never known of a resource to point to that says, okay, this is where they're doing it, this is how they're doing it. But you say their website is still giving information on that.
Right, because after their program closed, they kept their sample bylaws or their membership agreement online so that other people could start similar programs. So that's a good resource. And yeah, I mean, it's too bad our public transportation systems aren't better so that we have to do things like this ourselves. But I guess in rural areas, it's really hard to get buses to go out there.
Mm. So you can find this website for Go Geronimo. You can probably also just find it by doing an internet search. But you can find the exact URL for it, plus many other resources in the book, The Sharing Solution, How to Save Money, Simplify Your Life, and Build Community. We're talking with one of the authors of the book, Janelle Orsi, on WDEV Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettinger. You can join the conversation. Tell us about sharing your cars, your chickens, your lawnmowers, whatever, your cable internet. At 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. I want to shift gears. I don't want to give the impression that the sharing solution is all about sharing transportation options, although there's much good information in there about that. But let's go to housing. Talk about the various ways that you've seen people share housing.
Well, there's a whole spectrum of things that we talk about in the book, and a lot of times when people hear shared housing, what they picture is a cooperative house or a group house that might have, 14 people and two bathrooms, for example.
Maybe a commune.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a whole spectrum of different ways you can arrange housing where you really can have a lot more space than that, and one thing we talk about is how people can buy houses with other people. You might team up with a friend, or another family member and purchase a house. I mean, there's all these what they call McMansions out there, really huge homes that people can't afford right now, but which could actually have enough space to house two households, two families. And sometimes it might involve a little bit of retrofitting. One woman I know, or we actually wrote about it in the book, she took her house and built an addition onto it that is attached to her kitchen. And so there's a whole family living in this addition, sharing the kitchen with her, and then she lives on the other side of the kitchen. So the kitchen is sort of the connector between the two units. So that's a creative way that people are sharing housing and having a lot of their own personal space, but at the same time reducing their square footage and reducing their expenditures and so on. But we also talk about co-housing, which is sort of a movement growing up around the country. There's over 100 co-housing communities in this country and many more that are in the works. And what it is a lot of people refer to it as intentional neighborhoods where people have their own units it might be 30 or 50 households, and each one has their own unit with a kitchen, bathroom, and bedrooms, and so on. But they're all built and designed around a central space that might have a large common house. And in the common house, there's a large commercial-sized kitchen where people share meals a few times a week. There's a guest house, perhaps, a workshop, a garden space, chickens, probably, a dining area. And so people end up getting access to a whole lot more space. They have a community that's built in around them of people who are intentionally sharing and cooperating. And so it's a really great way to live.
One of the guests I've had on this show a couple times, I think, is James Howard Kunstler, and he talks about peak oil and how energy scarcity in the future is going to make the suburbs pretty much untenable as living arrangements, and he foresees all these scattered McMansions being divided up into multifamily apartments, and he paints a picture of it happening as a really desperation. You sort of get the sense that there's going to be squalor associated with it. But Janelle Orsi, you're painting a picture of how people now can very deliberately choose their neighbors, divide up these McMansions or other homes that that they have access to, and build a positive community.
Right, right. It's very proactive. I don't think we need to wait till the system falls apart to start building the world that we want to see. And even if we don't have the need, if we don't need to save money necessarily, it's just building that community around you can just really increase the quality of life. And, it just makes the world a safer and more beautiful place.
And I understand, both from talking to people involved in co-housing projects and from seeing your comments in the sharing solution, that some sort of shared living space, a common room or a common building, even depending on the size of the co-housing unit, is pretty important for building that community, for the community to thrive. What are your comments on that?
Well, it's interesting because, for the most part, that is a essential part of co-housing. It's part of the definition, is having that common space. But where I live in my neighborhood, there are three households, the house behind me and the house in front of me across the street, where we've decided to create something called casual co-housing. And we don't exactly have a common space because we really look like a typical neighborhood. But what we do is we just try to share and cooperate on a much higher level than normal neighbors would. So I have a garden space at my neighbor's house across the street because they have space for vegetable gardening. And my neighbors across the street and I trade meals. Like, they cook for me on Mondays and I cook for them on Wednesdays. And my neighbors in the back, I use their laundry room because there's no washing machine in my own house. And and we all just do a lot of things together. The kids in the community have all sort of grown up around us. And in terms of our common space, we share a grill, we share a picnic table and a yard in the garden space. And so we try to get out and have dinners with each other from time to time, but it's but that's why we call it casual co-housing. It's not quite as structured as other co-housing communities people may have heard of.
And we've talked primarily about sharing housing and transportation. Your book, The Sharing Solution, goes into sharing food, sharing care, sharing at work. About 30 seconds, what would you say about some of these other types of sharing?
Well, I just think we could really revolutionize the way we live if we start thinking about sharing household goods. Like, if you have a vacuum cleaner, you could share it with many of your neighbors. And if you have yard space, you could all get together and start cultivating food there and just grow things a lot more locally. And doing meal trading could save each other a lot of time and also help you all eat better. So I think the possibilities for sharing are just endless in our neighborhoods, and people should get together and start brainstorming ways to do it.
Janelle Orsi, attorney and author of The Sharing Solution, How to Save Money, Simplify Your Life, and Build Community. Thanks for joining us all the way from the Bay Area in California.
Thank you so much, Carl. It's been a pleasure.
Goodbye. And The Sharing Solution is available at that Ultimate in Institutionalized Sharings, the Kellogg Hubbard Library, at least. And if your local library doesn't have it, let them know to get it in, The Sharing Solution. As oil prices climb, our incomes are shrinking, and as the economy is going down, I think almost all of us have less money to work with. So sharing's a way to address that, to help us feel wealthier, even be wealthier. I mean, some of the things that she writes about sharing in here are things like saunas and hot tubs, which I don't know about you, but I don't have access to those right now. Plus, you get the stronger community, and that's one of the things this show is all about. I'm Carl Etnayer. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. I'll be back next Monday, 1 o'clock. Tomorrow, Travin comes in. Anthony Polina is in on Wednesday and Thursday. On Friday, Tom Hartman will be talking with Bernie Sanders or somebody like that. Don't forget to check EqualTimeRadio.com for podcasts of the shows that Travin and I host. Artie Levine produced the show. And it's AP Network News coming up next, and then music with Jack Donovan for the rest of the afternoon. Thanks for tuning in.